Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
And you know me, you know Greg's still walking that path of spiritual progress. And I'm not here to preach that big book. So we need to talk about that a little bit. But you know, what an honor and a privilege it is to be here tonight and share a little of my experience, strength, and hope with y'all. And man, howdy. Y'all sure do things up big in Texas, don't you? And, you know, I'm still following suggestions myself because they seem to be working. And I want to take this time an opportunity to thank the committee for asking me to come out here and to tell my story. And, you know, so many of us come to these conferences and roundups, and you know, on page 132, it says, "We're not a glum lot. We absolutely insist on enjoying life." And man, howdy, I love to do that. But every time I do this, my sponsor, I always remember, he said, "You better thank everybody involved." And, you know, we really don't give enough credit. We come here, we stay 3 days, and we go back home. But this thing wasn't done overnight or over a week or in over a month. It takes about a year to get ready for these things. And just looking at these little doilies up here and the many, many people, and one of my bad character defects I still got is, you know, it talks about the main problem of the alcoholic centers in the mind, and I slap can't remember everybody's name. And I'm not going to try to, but Donna sitting there looking at me smiling, and Marie, and Donna run that hospitality room, and she's the only one in there this morning when I got over there because I was an early bird. And Bobby and Jimmy Kay and Greg and Steve, and I'm going to stop right there because I don't know everybody's name. And I've met so many people, and I had a gentleman come up last night, and he said, "Are you the dignitary from Georgia?" I said, "No, sir, I really am not. I'm a drunk from Georgia." Boy, I like that word, though, dignitary. But I got to watch that ego. And it is great to be out here. And my brother, I got a brother who lives in Austin, Texas. And I hadn't seen him in several years. And so we decided on making this trip, we would fly in there and spend a few days with him and then come on and drive up here. And we went to the Alamo, and we went to that riverboat walk. Boy, did we walk. I didn't like that too much. I like the riding better. And there's old Jimmy Kay. I won't ever forget about 10 months ago, 9, 11, something. Greg called me, and he said, "I got a young lady here would like to speak to you, Papa." I said, "Well, put her on there." And he said, "Her name's Jimmy Kay." And so I got on that phone, and she said, "Papa, we just had a meeting, and we would sure love to have you come out here and tell your story to the people in West Texas." And she said, "We'll fly you out and fly you back, and we'll take care of your expenses and put you up in a hotel or a motel, and we'll provide you for a hostess for them 3 days." And I said, "Will she look like Britney Spears?" But she was honest. She said, "No, not really." And I got Greg. Boy, this is a program of deflation, isn't it? But that's the way it works. And, you know, it's been great. It's been fun. And, you know, my brother took us out to, y'all going to have to help me, because sometimes I talk a little slow. Boy, that Diane can go, can't she? I got a daughter that's a school teacher, too, and she can zip through that stuff, and I'm not that quite that quick. But, boy, she can get it, can't she? But we went out to, where was it, Lake Travis, and my brother had a beer, and his wife, and I got a big old glass of iced tea, and, you know, that's so funny. He said, "Does this really bother you?" And I said, "No, not one bit." You know, it bothered him more than it did me. And what we can really do, is it not true when we are spiritually fed? It's hard to believe. So many things that I never thought I'd be able to do. And he had another one. He had two, and I kind of got a little resentment. I said, boy, he's not alcoholic, is he? But we've had a wonderful trip and a wonderful time, and it's good to be here. And I still follow suggestions, so I want to introduce my little lovely wife. And if it's God's will, come August the 23rd this year, we'll be celebrating 42 years of sobriety. And Donna, would you stand? Oh, is that? I'm going to have to take a tenth step on that. How about marriage? Whew, thank God Bill gave us a tenth step. Sometimes he knew we wasn't quite playing with a full deck, didn't he? But my lovely wife, and you know I better start this thing off right, and that's the way I generally do it. I have four children and five grandchildren, and they all call me Papa, and I'm an alcoholic. Well, y'all better wake up a little bit here. And let me see where I'm going to go from here. Okay. It has absolutely been great. And I'm going to tell you just a little bit about myself and how I got to this fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous. And 2 months ago, I lost my sponsor. And his name was Frankie Rice. And in 1984 and 85, he was a state delegate to Alcoholics Anonymous from the state of Georgia. And I knew him 40 years. And I wasn't born in Georgia. I've lived there for 40 years. I originally was born in West by God, Virginia. And most of my people lived in Ohio. And I do have to tell you one thing. When I was a-drinking, one time, I was a president of the union for the company I worked with for many years. And I flew all over this country negotiating contracts. And I got on a flight in Atlanta on the way to Chicago. And I done had me a few little toddies there. And I sat there, and all of a sudden, I got down in my seat, and I seen this little old gal getting on that plane. Man, howdy, yeah, she looked good. She looked like a little old fox. That's what we called them in my days. And she come walking back towards me. And all of a sudden, she sat down. And son, I was getting a little hot and sweating and bothered, and I said, whew, what a pretty little thing sitting here beside me. And I said, I wanted to strike up a conversation, and I'd had enough that wasn't going to be very hard. And I said, you on the way to Chicago? She said, yes, I am. And I said, business or pleasure? She said, business. She said, I'm going to the annual Nymphomaniac convention in Chicago. And that thing wasn't going very good then, and because the next question was, what are you going to be doing there? And she said, I'm going to be a lecturer. And I said, you're going to lecture? She said, yeah, I'm going to debunk some of the myths about sexuality. I said, you kidding me? I said, like what? She said, well, the myth that the most well-endowed is a African-American. And that's not true. In fact, the truth is that belongs to the Native American Indian. I said, you don't say. The Native American Indian. Another myth. That the best lovers were of the French descent. And that's not true. It happened to be the people of the Jewish descent. I said, well. And she said, well, we found out the best potential lover of all time was the old Southern redneck. And she kind of blushed and got a little flustered in, and she said, "I don't know why I'm telling you all this stuff." She said, "I don't even know your name." And I said, Tonto Goldstein. And they all call me Bubba. You know, we gotta laugh, because that's what sobriety's about, and when I go someplace to get that privilege or opportunity to tell my story. You know, I went to a meeting this morning with Greg over at someplace. And where was it, Greg?
Sherwood.
Yeah, and we talked about honesty and how vitally important that is. But to me, when we have these roundups and these conferences, I think it's time to have a little fun. And that's the reward of being sober today. But anyway, we went out this morning, me and Greg and Bobby and Jimmy Kay, and we went to IHOP to eat, and they were two little ladies sitting over at the other table beside us, and they was a-talking, and I could not believe what they were talking about, and I'm a little deaf anyway. And I heard one's name was Mabel, and the other one was Ethel. And she said, "Mabel," said, "you got a suppository in your ear." And Greg was sitting across from me, and I punched Jimmy Kay and said, "Jimmy Kay, what the hell did she say?" And she said, "Papa," she said, "she told that other lady she had a suppository in her ear." Now, about that time, Ethel reached up and took that thing out and said, "Thank you, Mabel. Thank you, thank you, thank you." And she said, "Why?" She said, "I think now I know where my hearing aid's at." These rewards of laughter and being funny, that's what sobriety's about. If we can laugh, you know, we'll probably return to doing what we used to do. And if it was like me, I'd drink a lot of liquor. And at one time, it was a lot of fun. And then it become a habit, and then that obsession. Never, ever did I figure that was going to happen to me. And where I worked, and I worked over 35 years with the same company, and we worked shift work, and we would work 7 in the morning and get off at 3 in the afternoon, and next week we'd work 3 in the afternoon and get off at 11 at night, and the next week 11 at night and get off at 7 in the morning. And I'd done that over 35 years, and we never could get adjusted, and it was nothing like getting off 7 o'clock in the morning and having a beer. But that didn't last but a couple years, and then it got to be a little bit stronger. Never knowing that was one thing. I had no intention on being an alcoholic, because, you know, Greg and we was talking about that. Big Book talks about we have to drop some lifelong conceptions. And what I visualized an alcoholic really was, that man up underneath that bridge. And I knew that wasn't going to happen to me. Because I worked and made a lot of money, I traveled around, and never, ever did I want to become an alcoholic. It's so funny. I was talking about my sponsor, who I lost just a couple months ago. Back in the mid-80s, he was the employee assistance program coordinator at the factory, and when people had problems there, and I was president of the union, I really didn't get involved with most of the things till they looked like it was going to arbitrations, and it was a termination, and we'd sit down with that employee and go through that record and look at it, and usually it was a lot of absenteeism that always showed up. And I told him, some of them, I just slapped down, son, we ain't got much to work with here. And but if we'll tell them, you got a problem, that's a disease. And I had no idea what I was doing. Really didn't even care that much for that employee at that time. All I was trying to do was make myself look good and save his job. And I could ship him off to treatment, and many of them recovered. Some of them didn't. But the main thing I wanted to do was save his job. And some of them, we ended up just about putting them in straight jackets. But I've seen some of them today with 17, 20 years sobriety. Never did I feel that that would ever happen to me. And I pretty well thought I had done things upright. Oh, man, howdy. Time flies, don't it? Don't you hate it when an alcoholic starts looking at your watch? You know you're going to be here a while, but I'm not going to do that to you. I hope. But I retired at the age of 55, and I was sitting on top of the world. And I kind of was felt like I was like Frank Sinatra and Elvis. I'd done it my way, and I'd done it up good. And boy, did it go down here from then. When I retired, I thought, man, from here on, it's going to be party, party, party. And it went party, party, party. It went backwards. It just didn't work the way I had it figured out. And today I realized that was God's plan. I spent so many years working with other people and representing them in that union. And I had done it so long, I really didn't want to do that anymore. And one day I was sitting at home, and I would get up, and the one thing about it, I was so smart, I thought, the main thing I'll not do is become an alcoholic, and I will never take a drink before noon. And boy, I've been retired 2 or 3 months, and I'd watch that clock. Not really till I sat down and wrote that first step, and it talked about the preoccupation of the mind. And that worked okay for a few months. And I thought, well, son, you doing so damn good now that you could probably have one at 11 o'clock in the morning. So at 11 o'clock, I would start having one. And that went on for a very short time. And it was 10 o'clock and 9 o'clock in the morning and 8 o'clock and 7 o'clock. And when I first got up, and I'll never forget, right before I hit that bottom, my daughter, she, like I was saying about Diane, she's also a school teacher, and she come by the house one day. My wife was working, and she had that little baby with her, and he was about 6 months old, and he crawling across the floor, and I was drunk. And she said, Daddy, you okay? And I said, you betcha. I'm doing just fine, honey. Can I get you anything? No. I don't need anything. And she left. I had 2 half-gallons I kept in the kitchen underneath the sink. And I never thought really till I'd been in a fellowship for a few years about the fear of running out like Dr. Bob talked about in his story. And I kept 2 half-gallons in the dining room in the butler. And in the basement, I kept 2 half-gallons down there. And in the back seat of my pickup, I kept 1/2 gallon. Son, I wasn't going to run out of liquor. And that thing was my best friend. For many years, it done for me what I couldn't do for myself. Never knowing anything about a progressive disease called alcoholism. And each day it got just a little bit worse and a little bit worse. And my wife, she worked for a doctor, and I'd had some surgery, cataracts, and she come home one night and she said, you know, when I gotta tell you this too, because it is very important. I weigh 240 pounds a day. And I got a picture, if you want to look at it when we get done. When I went in the last treatment center, I weighed 138. When I retired, I weighed 190. And one of the first things that made me wake up and see myself in this big book called Alcoholics Anonymous was chapter 3 on page 32 about that man retiring at 55. And 4 years later, he was dead. And I lived. I went 2 years, 2 months, and 2 days and had lost over 50 pounds. And today I gained over 100 pounds. Boy, we go from one addiction to another. So food tastes good today, and I love to eat. And, you know, I just wanted to die. Death didn't, I did not fear. It was living what was miserable for me. I was miserable before the drink, during the drink, and after the drink. My normal day was to wake up at 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning, and I didn't want my wife to know I was drinking so much. I go in there and get that cup of coffee, and I put about 2 or 3 ice cubes in it, filled up with half liquor and half water. Sometimes after 7, she'd be getting up and, whoo, I done had a buzz going. And I didn't want her to know I was drinking that much. And I didn't know a thing about that word called denial. And come a little after 8, she would leave to work. And I'd say, whew, thank God. Now I can do some serious drinking. And I'd pour that little coffee cup out and I'd get me a glass and I'd fix it full of half liquor and half water. And drank to oblivion. Just like the book said, it had become my master. And I would do that till 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And then pass out. And she would come home many a night. I'd see her come in at 5:30. And go in there and get some good groceries out there and fix some cube steak and gravy and some green beans. Slice them tomatoes up and have a big dinner fixed with some rolls. And, honey, I got a good supper fixed. And I said, and honey, I ate about 2 sandwiches before I went to bed, and I've had one hell of a day today. And I'm not really hungry right now. I'm going to watch some of this ball game. And I hadn't had a bite. So I'd fix me another drink. And I'd start again. And thank God for 10 o'clock at night, she'd say, it's just about time I'm going to bed. And I said, well, you don't worry, because I'm going to put things away. And thank goodness she'd go to bed, and I walk in there, and I grab a couple pieces of that cube steak and put on a paper plate. And even today, where we live, we got a big 3-story house, over 4,000 square feet and 3 acres of land. And I go down in the basement and open up that refrigerator and put them 2 pieces of cube steak in there, and I come back up and get the garbage can and take a lid and some of that stuff out of there and scrape in them pole beans and some mashed taters and sliced tomatoes and cucumbers and cover it all back up nice and neat and put everything in the refrigerator and get up in the morning and swear, honey, that's the best supper you ever fixed. How delicious it was, and I hadn't eaten a bite. It just got worse. And to this day, and I know there's many definitions of hitting that bottom, and I know I hit the old-fashioned bottom, and I'm hoping there's somebody here with a new into this program that can see some of me in you and know we have a fatal terminal disease called alcoholism. And over any considerable period of time, it gets worse, never better. My wife had come home and said, Barbara Willie, said, you sure do look bad. And she said, you look like you're going to die. And I said, you know, she really needs to mind her own business. Because I had it all together and she had nothing going. She said, you know you're not going to live. And I knew that. I absolutely wanted to die. And I've been to some treatment centers before. They just didn't work. And she said, I'm going to make another call if you would like to try it. You know, kind of bad. Because, like I said about this little Al-Anon of mine, this was in September. And later on, after she told me her story, she said, we was hoping he'd sure die before Christmas so we could get straightened out on everything. Everybody knew I was dying, and I did too. And that didn't scare me. Yeah. That little Al-Anon gives me lots of suggestions today. And one thing about I found out about my Al-Anons and a lot of other ones. You know one thing about them Al-Anons, son? Basically, them female Al-Anons. Basically, mine. They don't snore. They don't sweat. They don't burp. They don't pass gas. Therefore, if they don't bitch, it'd blow up. Well, they got to, son. And we love them from the bottom of our heart, how much they mean to us. And I guess that's about, other than AA, the second best fellowship around. But anyway, she made that phone call and off to another treatment center. I just couldn't figure this thing out. So we got down there to Statesboro, Georgia, called Willingway. Where there's a will, there's a way. And we checked in there about noon, and I was trembling and nervous and underweight. But the worst thing, probably 6 months before I went in that treatment center, I knew I was dying, and I was losing control of my bowels, and I was losing control of my kidneys. And I told my wife, we got 5 big bedrooms. I said, you snore so damn much, honey, I'm going to move in another bedroom. I wasn't going to take the blame. It was her fault. Because I was dirtying up so many drawers, son, I was having to go to Kmart and buy new ones. I didn't want to put them in a hamper. And if I had to get a haircut or take care of some business, boy, we can figure things out. I'd go get some of that Imodium. And then I had to go get some extra strength Imodium because I was afraid I'd be getting a haircut and have an accident. My whole physical function was shutting down. I could eat nothing. I couldn't sleep. I was losing control of everything. And I still wasn't an alcoholic. So off to the hospital we went. And we got in there about noon one day. And boy, God does work in mysterious ways. And we sat in that hospital and they got me checked in. And about 2 o'clock that afternoon, we kissed and she left and come back home. It's about a little over, about a 4-hour drive back to Atlanta. And about 6 o'clock that night, I went into the DTs. And they took me out of that treatment center and took me to a hospital called Bullock Memorial Hospital and put me in the emergency room. And my temperature was up to 105 degrees. And they couldn't break it, and they couldn't get it down. And my liver wasn't functioning. And I still carry this discharge paper around. Well, I sure look at it today. When I left that hospital, it said, medical problems, alcoholism, chronic, alcohol-induced liver disease, hiatal hernia, colon polyps, precipital neuropathy. My liver wasn't functioning. All that poison had went to my feet, and they were swelled up big as basketballs. And today, each one of my feet feel like they got about 15 shots of Novocaine in them. I killed all the nerve endings in them. And I was still not an alcoholic. gastric reflux, anemia with hemoglobin positive in the stool. He's not bleeding bad. And they had three doctors there working on me. Dr. Whitlock, Dr. Tillman, and Dr. Bobby Mooney. And I was in ICU, and they had almost give up hope, and they called my wife. She had just got home and said, "We hate to tell you this, but you need to get back down here. We don't think your husband is going to make it through the night." She loaded up and back down she come. And you know, I didn't care if I made it through the night or not. The pain was so bad. And you know, I hear people talk about alcoholic bottom. And when the pain outweighs the pleasure. But the best definition I've heard of, and many people say, how do you know when you hit your bottom? And I say, when life gets worse faster than you can lower your standards. Think about that one. And that's what I was trying to do, and how very true that is in my life. But by today I realize it was by His only grace that I made it through that ICU, and I got into a hospital room, and I stayed there about a week. And I was coming to, and them doctors, how much I owe my life to them. And I'm glad I wasn't in Hot Atlanta at that time, because they wouldn't have known what to do with an alcoholic in that condition. And Dr. Tillman come in, and I said, "Man, I'm feeling better, son. I'm about ready to get out of here." And I said, "What all did you find wrong with me?" And I knew in my heart he was going to say, "You've got prostate cancer. You've got lung cancer. I knew all that." And he said, "You've got some very bad medical internal problems." But he said, "I think you're going to make it. But your worst problem is you're an alcoholic." And I said, "You don't say." "Well, I can handle that, Doc." And he said, "Well, okay." So I said, "I want to talk to that other doctor. I wasn't going to buy what one doctor told me. I was too smart for that." So that afternoon, after talking to Dr. Whitlock, Dr. Tillman come in, and I just was talking to that doctor. And he said that I was a chronic alcoholic. "Yeah, he did say that." And I said, "What you think?" He said, "I'm going to have to agree with him." Well, things started looking bad then, didn't they? I just didn't want to accept that. And I said, "Well, Doc, I'm going to tell you what. I've heard from you two. I want to hear from that other doctor." "Okay," he said, "there won't be no problem. We'll let you talk to him." And he didn't come in that day. And that afternoon, son, I had woke up. I was feeling a little bit better, and I guess they had done detoxed me to what they could anyway. And but I still couldn't control my bowels or anything. And man, I had needles sticking in my arms and down my throat and all over me, and both legs propped up in the air, because they swelled up like basketballs. But the one thing I wanted, I told my wife, "I want a cigarette." And she said, "You've got to be kidding." I said, "No, I want a cigarette." Well, she didn't have any. And I said, "Well, go back to that hospital they had put her up and get some of them, bring them back here." And I had them nurses, I couldn't get out of bed, son. They about had me tied down. It looked like them old days. Well, I wasn't being very cooperative. What'd they tell us? Defiance is outstanding characteristic of the alcoholic. Son, I didn't have a little. I was eat up with it. So my wife had left, and I had all kinds of buttons here to push if I had to do anything. And son, I had a pain hit me, and I had to go. But I was a little groggy. I wasn't real stable. But I didn't want to bother nobody, so I was going to do that myself. So I had to pull this little thing, and I come out of them straps, and I got this little thing, and this is honest to God's truth. I started in there at the bathroom. I got the door open. It's a pretty long bathroom. I didn't have no britches on anyway, but I couldn't get set down fast enough. I had a blowout. And only one cheek hit that thing, son, and I come tumbling off of there and busted my head against the wall, and I was a-bleeding. And I laid in that floor, and you know them little gowns only come down about here. I had that thing already up to the back of my neck. And I busted my head, and I couldn't get up. And I said, now, wait a minute, boy, I'm in a heap of trouble now. And I done had that blowout, so I looked over there and seen that little red thing hanging down. I said, pull here in case of emergency. And I couldn't get up, so I started scooting on my back. Then I had shoo-shoo from my head to my ears. It didn't look good and didn't feel good. But I had to have some help. And I laid down there, and I could not raise up and reach that thing. But all of a sudden, we alcoholics are very inventive, and I thought, man, I'm going to lay here and die and bleed to death, and I'm stinking pretty bad by now, and I got to have some help. But tell me we're not smart. I thought, you know what, maybe I could do it with my foot. I couldn't get my hand that high, so I raised my foot up, and I got it caught in that little red thing, and it's down it comes. Boy, you think I wasn't in some trouble? Don't they about five nurses come in there? And if I'm lying, I'm dying. And at least one, they were black. They looked like Aunt Jemima. And at least one weighed 300 pounds. What you doing down there? I looked back up at her and I said, I was slipping and a sliding. And that happened. And son, they commenced to hose me down right there. But they got me hosed down and got me back in that room, and they were angry. I thought I had an ass-whooping coming right there. Big time. And my wife come back, and boy, did they start in on her, and I liked that. That took some heat off of me. And the next day, that other doctor showed up. And I said, hey there, doctor, how you doing? He said, what in the world have you been into? I said, well, I'm getting better. He said, what is your problem? And I said, well, you know, doc, I'm gonna have a level with you. I done listened to them other two quacks. I want a doctor to tell me the real truth about me. And he said, well, what do you want me to tell you? I said, you know, them people said I'm alcoholic, I'm chronic. And I know better than that. And he said, you do? And I said, yes, sir, I do. And he said, then you'll die. Ooh, that got my attention kind of quick. I said, what do you mean I'll die? He said, you have a disease called alcoholism. And for you to drink is to die. He said, you see, it's only disease knowing the man that keeps telling you, you ain't got it. he said, how cunning, baffling, and powerful this disease is. And I said, well, what makes you think you're an authority on that? Because, see, I wasn't real satisfied yet. He said, you see, I'm an alcoholic and I'm a drug addict. I said, oh, okay. That had to be God sent. He was armed with the facts. And he talked a lot about himself. And I could see myself in him. And today that doctor and me, we are the best of friends. And I was visiting last weekend in Statesboro, Georgia. And we really related. So off to that little treatment center I went. And he talked about the three essentials of honesty, willingness, and an open mind. And a lot of things said I surely didn't want to hear. But today I realized they were the things I needed to hear. Now, I stayed there a couple months in that treatment center, and today I can honestly tell you, and I know many, many people I work with in treatment centers and hospitals, and the lives they've turned around. But I still honestly, in my heart, feel that them places is only one thing, their discovery. And recovery starts in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what happened to me. And it took a long time for my mind to clear. And when I left that facility, I went back home. And my wife had, she was driving me, and she didn't know what to think, and I didn't either. I had one tremendous fear, that I was just a little too goofy. I wasn't going to make this thing called AA. I just didn't really think I had a chance. But one thing about it, I'd known my sponsor, like I said, for over 40 years, and I knew he had a lot of recovery, and I knew he knew a lot about this fellowship called AA, and boy, was I scared. Boy, was I scared. And the first thing I did is I went to see him. And he said, man, you're going to have to make a lot of meetings. I said, okay. And he said, I want you to pick up that big book called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I picked that up, and you bet you I'm going to tell you one thing. I'm a big book thumper, because that thing saved my life. That is the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's what he told me. And he said, that's what we do with a textbook. We study it. And he said, we got to learn the program before we can live it. Didn't mean a lot of sense to me right then. Today it means everything. He said it was found in the first 164 pages. I said, wow. And them other places, when I seen that book, I seen it was that big. And I said, I ain't going to sit down and read all that thing. And he told me about them stories in the back. And he said, you too have a story. But the recovery is found in them first 164 pages. And I want you to read that thing. And we're going to read it together. But I want you to read it the first time by yourself. So. And I want you to make meetings, a lot of them. And I want you to get a pad, like I seen Greg today sitting down in a meeting, taking notes. Because what a learning program this is. What a learning program. So I took that little old stenographer's notebook, and I've done went through three or four of them, son. Because just like each and every person who goes to bed tonight, if you hadn't had a drink, you too are a winner. Off to them meetings I started. And I heard them talk about 90 meetings in 90 days. Well, I figured I was too far gone for things like that, and I guess it was only by God's grace that I was up each morning, and, man, at 10 o'clock I was going to a meeting, and at 1 o'clock I was catching another, and then at 5:30 I'd catch another, and then at 8 o'clock that night. And my first 90 days, I wrote them down. I took a little 3x5 index card, and I said, okay, there's another one, there's another one. I still got that card today, and in the first 90 days, I made 227 meetings. And then next 90 days, I think I made like 217. And the next 90 days, 220-some again, and then the last 90, that first year, 217. Or so. Anyway, 857 meetings that first year because I just knew I wasn't going to get it. But one thing about it, I had enough willingness. I had went through enough pain. And I read that big book, and I went through it, and I read that doctor's opinion, and each and every chapter thereafter, and I got done, and he said, okay, tell me what you found in that big book about you. And you know the only thing in this honest to God truth, because, see, that's what happened to me. I said, well, the only thing I can tell you, Frankie, that I seen in there about me was in that doctor's opinion. Anytime you leave out the physical factor of the alcoholic, the picture is incomplete. That's what Mr. William Duncan said. And you see, I got it all together, other than my physical part. Whoo, dog, and he said, son, you are real sick. I said, what you talking about? That's all I lost. I would have still been drinking if it wasn't for my health. He said, Papa, son, you are sicker than you ever thought you was. And he said, many meetings, many chances. Few meetings, few chance. No meetings, no chance. So I was willing to follow them suggestions. And he said, I got to ask you a question, son. He said, why did you drink to begin with? And I said, well, I drink because I liked it. And he said, why did you continue? I said, well, it got to be a habit. And why did you continue after that? And I said, I had to drink. Well, he said, then we're going to go to AA the very same way. You're going to go in the beginning because you have to go. You're going to continue going, and it will become a habit. And you're going to continue going because you want to. Whew, you think I wasn't taking his inventory out of all this? He's full of it. But you see, he knew me better than I knew myself. And that's why I go today, because I absolutely enjoy it. What a way to live. And what a journey it's been. And you think about when I read. So we went through there and we read that thing together and read it again and we read it again. And you go back and look at Dr. Silkworth, and it talks about that phenomenon of craving. And these people wasn't drinking to escape. They were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. And I said, that's a little bit of me. And they have to attain that psychic change. And I talked to my sponsor about it, attaining that psychic change, and he said, that's through them 12 steps called AA. And I heard people say, if it takes a week to walk into the forest, it's going to take a week to walk out. I said, son, as long as I've been drinking liquor, it's going to take me that long to get sober. I ain't never going to make it. And he said, it's not going to take you that long to get sober. It's going to take you 12 little steps. He kept it so simple. And he spoke from the heart. And then as we went through Bill's story, and it talked about simple but not easy, it meant the destruction of self-centeredness. We must turn things over to the Creator. Because I never knew how selfish I was. And then we go into that next chapter. There is a solution. That self-searching analysis. The leveling of the pride. Whoo! That pride will kill us. And that ego. And they always told me the acronym for that ego was easing God out. So many times we do that. And then getting into chapter 3, more about alcoholism. That was hard to accept. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. And over any considerable period of time, we get worse and never better. But how much I could see of myself in each and every word. And for people like going back to Dr. Carl Jung from Switzerland and Roland Hazard and Abby Thatcher, that beautiful November night. In 1934, he carried that message to Bill Wilson. And that gleam he'd seen in his eyes, and I'd go to them meetings at AA, and I'd look over there, and I'd look at some people, and I'd see that little twinkling in their eyes, and I'd say, what in the world have they got? I just didn't know, but I wanted some of it. It was just so hard to understand. And I think sometimes we complicate things so fast. And then as we start into that next chapter, more for we agnostics, suffering from an illness that can only be conquered by an spiritual experience. But man, howdy, I take me one of them. And I said, and he told me the same thing. That comes through them 12 steps. And then that famous chapter 5 deal, how it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail. And in 1950, you know, the first convention of Alcoholics Anonymous, some of them stopped Bill and asked him about them 164 pages. He said, would you change anything in there if you had the chance? And he said, yeah, I'd change one thing. I'd change that word from rarely to never. And boy, did that impress me a little bit. And I think that's the way it works today. You get out of this thing exactly what you put into it. It's a program of A-C-T-I-O-N. That's the way we spell gratitude, is by action. And doing it one day at a time, and what a joy it's been. And you know, I love reading that big book. And you know, my sponsor, he talked about trust God, clean house, and help others. And I thought, okay, I'm going to buy into that trust God, and I'm going to buy into that clean house. But son, if I ever get better, I ain't going to help not one little whistle dick. I'm going to go on home, and when I feel better, if a little cockroach runs across my kitchen floor, I get the little dustpan out, and I sweep that little feller up, and I'll pitch him outside. And today I realize how much the joy of sobriety is in working and helping other people. Man, that's a fun part of being sober. And that journey through them 12 steps, and whew, just like it says, who cares to miss complete defeat? And most of us on chapter 3 have been unwilling to admit we're real alcoholics. But you know what? Today, we've got over 20 million alcoholics in this country today, and a little over 2 million of us in recovery. That means 18 million of them are going to die. And that illusion that someday, somewhere, we will be able to drink again has to be smashed. We are not normal people. We have a fatal terminal disease called alcoholism. And I know today that for the alcoholic, there's only three possible outcomes: locked up, covered up, or sobered up. And it's been the best part of my life is recovery. Cunning, baffling, powerful, and my sponsor put in another word, patient. And boy, is it patient, sitting there waiting on us one day at a time. And I don't know. I just wouldn't know what to do without this program called AA. And for them people who, Bill, Bob, and them 100 that started this thing, and how many suffering alcoholic lives have been saved through them 12 steps and the admission of complete self-defeat. Oh, that's hard to suck up. But you know, on page 30, it tells us we learned. And what a learning program this is. We learned. We had to fully concede to our innermost self that we were alcoholics. That's the first step to recovery. I guess the biggest journey we make of our life starts from the head to the heart. People, this is not a head thing, it's a heart thing. And I see so many that don't quite get there. Them fears turn to love. Frankie told me the acronym for fear was face everything and recover, or F everything and run. And I decided to work them steps and live them. And, you know, so many people talk about page 449 in acceptance, and that new page is number 417 in that new edition. I done looked that thing up. But you know, really, if you think about it, acceptance starts in that first step. That's where it talks about it. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol. I wish it did say we admitted and accepted, but I'll sure point out real quick to that alcoholic, let's go to page 30, till we accept it in the heart. And in that 12 and 12, you know, it talks about till the alcoholic accept all his weaknesses and their devastating consequences. His sobriety, if any, will be precarious. So acceptance really starts in that first step. And, oh my goodness, I didn't know what time it was. But I'm going to close, and if you want to talk about recovery, I'll sit around and talk with you, because I love it. Because you people mean so much to me, and I'd like to talk about working them steps. And I sponsor a lot of men today. For the first 2 years and 8 months, I went into the correctional institution and worked with them people in the penal institutions. And so many people just don't really today even know about this program called Alcoholics Anonymous and how much work we've got yet to do today. And I'm going to close with just a... No, I want to say one more thing, because I usually talk about that and I don't have time. I'm running out of time already, but, you know, it talks about the main key to sobriety is humility. And we strive each day for the attainment of greater humility. And I asked Frankie, I said, son, how come we can't have true humility? He said, well, true humility, Papa, starts about 3 days after rigor mortis sets in. So we still strive to attain greater humility. We're going to leave it right there. But for me, I have to look at the way it's been for me. And we talked about that in that meeting this morning. And for me, there were five keys to sobriety in my life. And it starts with that honesty. To thine own self be true. And how hard it is to admit we got a problem. And I heard George T. talking about we can't solve a problem so we can define it. And Frankie used to tell me that 50% of fixing a problem is being able to define it. Whether you're driving down the highway and you hear a ka-flop, ka-flop, till you pull that car over and realize, man, we got a flat tire. You can't do nothing about it, can you, George? You have to define that problem. And I also think it's the first thing we probably lose. Them people I see today who have a slip or a relapse, they told themselves that big lie. This time it's going to be different. That's that insanity of this disease. Doing the same thing over and over, expecting different results. How vitally, vitally important to me honesty is. And you betcha, you get me in a corner now, I'll lie to you. And I don't mean to. It's just that I'm not perfect. I'll do a 10-step just like I did a while ago with you real quick. And I think the second most important thing is that big old word called surrender. That's in first three steps. we give up. The next six steps, we clean up. And the last three, the insurance policy to our sobriety. We work them every day. AA comes of age, says self-surrender is now and will always be considered the most vital turning point of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you yourself, if you've got some years of sobriety, you realize when you see somebody, they just couldn't surrender. They couldn't see our way of living. You know, the book tells us there must be no reservations nor any lurking notions. We surrender to win. And the third key to my sobriety was recovering on a spiritual basis. And I'm talking about them 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my sponsor never, he guided me through them. He hated to say, talk about work them. He said, we don't work them, we live them. It tells us that on page 85, the spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. And after working them, the fourth key, you work them 12 steps, you will attain that psychic change. That's a gift from up above. And the fifth one, you must remain spiritually active. That's what Bill and Bob said in a family effort. The two young men found they had to continue to grow spiritually. It's about progress, not perfection. Page 114, and that 12 and 12 said, when we place spiritual growth first, then and only then do we have a real chance. We just have to get to know him better. And we have to get out of self. Man, it's amazing how well I feel when I'm not thinking about myself. And you too will find out the same thing. But I used to go to Frankie, my sponsor, and say, man, howdy, Frankie, I got a problem. And he'd look at me and he said, no, you don't. You have an opportunity to grow, to demonstrate his omnipotence. Boy, I tell my sponsors the same thing when they come to me. Papa, I got a problem. I said, the hell you say, you got an opportunity. And that's what these things turn into, people. Opportunity to demonstrate how we have grown. What a wonderful way to live. And how many times I walk to him, I'd bring something up and he'd tell me, just go read them 9 words across the page number 83. Yes, there is a long period of reconstruction ahead. Them 9 words. I was sick of him telling me to read them 9 words. Because sometimes we don't have a lot of patience. But another beautiful thing is on page 87, and that's about spiritual growth, and it talks about what used to be a hunch. For an occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. We have to live it. We have to demonstrate it. You know, it talks about, on page 19, I just couldn't believe that. It says, elimination of our drinking was but a beginning. And then on 64, it talks about, our liquor was but a symptom. And then on page 82, it says, we think a man is unthinking when he says sobriety is enough. Man, howdy, they're going real fast for me. But today I realize it's only done one day at a time. One day at a time. And it's what we can do together that we could never, ever do by ourselves. Boy, I tried to. And on, you know, chapter 4, we agnostics are. It said if a mere code of morals or better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered a long time ago. And then you people sat there and told me, we can't think our way into sober living. We have to live our way into sober thinking. And that's the way it works. Now, what a ride it's been. And I'm going to close with this little poem that Frankie gave me. And it says, for we have to weather weather, many, many storms. And it goes, after the storm, after the storm there will be peace. Keep the faith and love will increase. There will be peace down in my soul. God's grace and mercy will make me whole. Through this all, I will be free. You're looking at a miracle when you see me. Thank y'all. All right.